It is February 9th, 2019. This is Deanna Spingola, and I'm broadcasting from the frigid Chicago suburbs. Yesterday morning, my front door was frozen shut, and this morning, when I walked into my office, it was 52 degrees. I keep the door of my office closed because it's cat-free. But this morning I thought, oh, I better open the door. I can't sit in a 52-degree office and do a radio program. So I opened the door. It's kind of, I don't think the insulation is good in this room. It's an outside room. You know, it's on the exterior of my home. And so I think when they were putting in the insulation, I think they may have not got an adequate amount. Anyway, it's like an oven in the summer and a refrigerator in the winter. So I opened the door, and of course the two cats came in, and Leo not only is a narcissist, but he's also a little thief, so he takes things off the desk. So anyway, but we're here. And I do appreciate you joining me today at republicbroadcasting.org. I invite you to visit and subscribe to SpingolaSpeaks.net and ScreeningSandyHook.net. During the program, email questions or comments to comment@Spingola.email. I invite you also to visit our chat room, which is usually very friendly and inviting. And you may do that by visiting spingola.chatango.com. You may view our past, current, and future guest lineup at spingola.com. When you visit the website, spingola.com, you click on the radio schedule button. It's on the left-hand side. You pick the year, the month, and you will see all kinds of, well, I think it's wonderful information because it has links to all of our past guests. It has links to relevant topics, relevant books, relevant everything. And so it's really quite a nice resource for the listeners of this program. And I do sincerely appreciate all of my listeners. I know that you can, particularly on Saturday, there are probably things that you have to do, that you'd rather do. So I do appreciate you listening to the program. And you will find that schedule all the way back to October 23rd, 2010, which is when I first began broadcasting on RBN. Just visit spingola.com and click on the appropriate button. My guest today, and let me give you the phone number because we will have callers, excuse me, in the third hour, and that telephone number is 800-313-9443. I'm very honored today to have a guest. I've interviewed him before. We have a lot of commonality. It's such an honor to have Dr. Matthew Bethel Johnson on my program, and his website is rusjournal.org. And Dr. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Deanna, it's been far too long. The honor is all mine.
Well, thank you. I just feel we do have so much in common, and I so appreciate your work. And so I'm very happy to have you back in my environment. And we cannot wait this long in the future.
Oh, I agree.
In your latest work, which you were thoughtful enough to send, and it's going to be featured, tell us where that's going to be featured. It's going to be featured at the Barnes Review.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm working on so many things at the same time. I can never remember.
That's what I do, too.
Yeah, I don't even remember how many books I have out. I think it's 9. I think you're referring to my latest book on the Soviet Union.
Yes, Life Russia. Has Become More Joyous, Revisionist Essays on Soviet History.
That's right, and that's that line, of course, comes from Stalin. He wrote an article in Pravda about the gaiety that he was seeing throughout the USSR since he had been chairman of the party. So that's a pretty funny thing. I couldn't resist having that as a title. Life is far more, the gaiety is overwhelming. Life has become more happy, more joyous, more laughter. So.
Yes, especially in the Ukraine, right? In the early 1930s. Really joyful.
And so it's funny in a very dark way.
Yes.
But these are essays that I've published all over the place, Barnes Review and elsewhere. And I realized, of course, they have a lot of things in common. And, put another book together. And so I did an introduction and conclusion. I dedicated it to a bunch of people, and that was it. So I'm actually pretty proud of it. I don't like what I write or what I say. I'm usually very, very critical. But this one, it's something that needs to be said, and no one's saying it. But speaking of books, I do want to say that this is not, any kind of a flattery here, but I usually dislike much of what the far right puts out intellectually. But The Ruling Elite is an excellent book. I've been recommending it all over the place. Usually our stuff has a lot of amateur elements to it, poor reasoning, but it's an excellent work.
Thank you. And you're talking about my trilogy, and I thank you for that.
Well, I just have the one, The Ruling Elite.
Number three.
It is one that has a Hawaii section in it.
Yes, probably that's three. It might be. I'll have to look. I will have to look.
It was given to me by a fan, and that the Hawaii just happened to be my favorite because I was just reading about that at the time. Very few people know about that. And just you're an excellent writer, an excellent historian in a movement that doesn't have many of those. Our academic work is very, very paltry. I seem to have to do everything. And it's really because we've been shut out of academia, of course. That's not to flatter you. That's a serious work of history, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and I appreciate you appreciating it.
Well, that's good.
In your acknowledgments, which I'm an empath, and when I read your acknowledgments, I just my heart goes out to you for some of the things that you have experienced, and something else that struck me is where you ended up. You ended up in Johnstown, PA, and I did. In one of my books, I wrote about Johnstown and the Johnstown flood, which I think a lot of people are familiar with, but a lot of people are not familiar with the fact that it was a deliberate event.
No question.
That was caused and created by some people who wanted to take over a business, the iron business.
There's no doubt.
And so they just decided to eliminate, the company along with thousands of other people. And it just didn't matter who they killed or who they flooded or what they did, as long as that event caused them or helped them to develop or gain a monopoly in the iron business. And when I read that that's where you're from, I thought, oh my gosh, what a coincidence that you would end up there, that you would be there, settle there. And, anyway, we don't always recognize or understand some of the things that are happening. And I'm thinking in conjunction with the deliberate flood in that area, I'm just kind of thinking about this unseasonable. Well, it's not unseasonable, but the extremities, the extreme cold and the extreme everything that we seem to be experiencing recently. I think it's it's just a little bit unusual, particularly when you consider California and when you combine the destruction in so many states and then consider that weather manipulation was something that they were participating in Vietnam during the war against Vietnam, one has to ask questions. So.
Was your Johnstown article in the ruling elite book? I can't remember.
Yes, it was in the, it may have been in the second one. I'll have to look that up. I'll bring up all three of the trilogy.
I came across that. Of course, you know, the Johnstown, the Flood Museum is right around the corner from me.
Wow.
I've been there many times. I've spoken to, people who specialize in it. In public, they won't say that it's deliberate. Frick in particular.
Right.
Was the main guy. It was very clumsy. I mean, you know, they were deliberately taking material out of the dam.
Yes.
To, you know, the fishing and hunting, the, Conemaugh Fishing and Hunting Club.
Right.
And for the very elite. And they were deliberately making the dam weak. They had warning after warning. And the reason that they made the dam weak is they were taking wood out of it to make the road wider so you could have carriages go both in and out.
Right.
And it went on top of the, and they knew exactly what they were doing. When you pull this stuff out, and then you have a valley underneath you, and so when it happened, there's no question, it wiped out, pretty much everything. It's tremendous force. There's a church here that has a sign that says the only building that was left standing, which is, the Catholic Church down here. And there's no doubt, deliberately weakening this, was a way to destroy, and again, not to mention the huge working class down there.
Oh, big, big, huge working class.
Russians and Germans.
Yes.
And wiping them out, and starting over again. That this was, it was not only a deliberate, thing, but it was poorly, you know, they weren't trying to hide it. It was so
right.
obvious. So, but back then they didn't have the internet, so.
Right, and they all, Frick, you mentioned, this gentleman by the name of Frick, his partner was Carnegie. So it's, and he never did, he always thought that, that monopolies were bad, and he figured that in the book that he wrote, figured that the government should take care of business. He wrote, what did he say? He said, to leave monopolists in control would not be tolerated by the people. Therefore, there must be control, and that control, as far as one sees, must be in the hands of the general government. Now, he wrote a two-part essay, Gospel of Wealth, in 1889. And it's just amazing what they did, and as you say, one building was left standing. Oh, terrible. Terrible.
Well, I could look out my window and I could actually see, because I'm on a mountain, I could see down the empty factories that are still there, the empty foundries.
Wow.
So the ruling class destroyed that place by a flood in 1889, and they destroyed it through globalization, you know, roughly 100 years later.
Yes.
And Johnstown is in a permanent state of depression. Its population is shrinking. Its pot, you know, potholes are everywhere. Homes are cheap, but, and this used to be one of the most prosperous, one of the central towns in American industrialization.
Yes.
Johnstown, both for steel and then sending coal to Pittsburgh. So the ruling class has destroyed Johnstown numerous times in numerous ways.
And the potholes are not only just existent in Johnstown. There are potholes all over in many areas. In fact, they were just talking about it on the news just in this last week. The potholes here in the Chicago area are just immense, where it's causing a lot of damage to cars, and it's terrible. And of course, they build roads here in this country that are designed to fall apart, And certainly, those in the Chicago area and the suburbs are really falling apart.
Yeah, the infrastructure is falling apart. I was commissioned to do a paper on the legal issues, in Western Pennsylvania, potholes. And I was actually struck by what I discovered. I discovered that, the state government, county governments have insulated themselves from any responsibility, damage to your car or accidents or anything like that. The standard is, there has to be a written warning sent from a motorist to the proper office in the county. And then there has to be a reasonable length of time for them to fix it. So if you wreck your car, get into an accident, and you say this should have been fixed, well, if there's no written note warning the city about that there's this huge pothole here, they're completely immune. Wow. I have a feeling if they had to pay for, I don't know if it's the same in other states. I'm pretty sure it is, because if they had to pay for damages caused by potholes, there wouldn't be any potholes. But as the weather is more and more extreme, as you mentioned, I see kids swimming in these potholes sometimes. And it's not only that doing damage to cars, which no one around here can afford, but it's also causing a lot of accidents.
Well, there are many industries, not just county governments, but industries that protect themselves by making public announcements so that they are immune from prosecution. And it's pretty sad. And the taxpayer always pays for their own destruction, it seems, in just about every case.
Well, in Johnstown, you know, and I think a lot of the old industrial cities, Pittsburgh didn't do a bad job in rebuilding. They really didn't. But other places, you know, Duluth, even parts of St. Louis, it's still just impoverished. They never quite recovered from the crash. There's no money. There's nothing for these people. It's always the same group of people who run everything. It's an oligarchy. No real civic consciousness. No real political movement of any kind. One of my favorite words is abulia, which means a lack of will or a lethargy that comes from the belief that nothing can be done and that there's really nothing worth fighting for. And I see that everywhere, not just here, but it's extreme here, but I see that everywhere. You know, the American taxpayer was forced to bail out the banks not too long ago.
Right.
The banks are now doing the exact same thing that they got in trouble for in 08.
Right.
Nothing has changed because pretty soon they're going to run out of money. The economy is far worse, and I know you know this, is far worse than we're told. Inflation is far worse than we're told. You know, the unemployment figure is the lowest, you know, U2 figure that they have, which is just people who are collecting benefits. That's what the unemployment figure reflects. There's lots of unemployed people who don't collect benefits. Unemployment is probably about 20%, and that includes underemployment. So the system does everything it can to protect itself from any kind of criticism. And the most obnoxious part is the belief that governments have anything to do with the economy. No, investment decisions are not made by presidents and congressmen. They're made by multimillionaires that most people have never heard of before.
Right.
And using the state to take the blame for a bad economy is very, very convenient for these people. And so it goes back to the same, you know, frickin' Carnegie and the same behavior. They know they can get away with it. They know that there's only a handful of independent press outlets here. So that's how it is.
Right. All righty. We are going to a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
All righty, thank you so much. And I welcome back. Our guest is Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, and I'm very happy to have some new music. I thought, oh, it's a new year, and a friend of mine suggested that I change the music, and the music that you are listening to is from my other, when I was doing another broadcast And I just love the thoughts that are in that song. So anyway, I hope that you enjoy that. Anyway, our guest website is rusjournal.org. And we were talking about government corruption, and we were talking about the Johnstown flood. And I do write about that in the book that you have. And the book that you have is the second in the trilogy. And I talk about a lot of stuff. The Johnstown flood is I wrote about that in the chapter called Managing Competition and Other Petty Annoyances.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right. You know, it's dangerous to do a huge survey like you've done because, you know, we can't be experts on everything. But I'm a specialist in Russian history, as you know, and your Russia section is actually very, very good. Usually people, you know, because it's such a different society, you can't use Western terminology to describe it. It's usually a disaster. The minute you use, you know, contemporary terms to refer to another civilization's history, you know, words like human rights or equality or something like that, you know that these people are amateurs.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't do that, especially with something as foreign to Americans as Russia. But you've gone over a lot of old information and did an excellent job with it. You know, I didn't throw the book across the room like I usually do with people. I didn't scream and yell. So congratulations. You did an excellent job in the Russia section, and especially when it comes to the royal family and the role of whether it be the Jews or major bankers and how fake the revolution was. A lot of our people know this, but and it's one of the reasons I got into this field is the fraud, whether it be the Cold War or, you know, really anything about the, I wrote this book on the USSR because the entire operation was a fraud. It's one of the reasons I got fired from my academic job. I've been a professor all over the country and I've been fired from every single one, I'm proud to say, while being the most popular professor on campus by far and having more publications than any two professors put together. Because the entire thing is a scam, and it's really hard to lecture the standard view when you know this to be a fact. And since it's our job as historians to take away the appearances of the veil and expose what's underneath, you figured I'd be celebrated for this, but surprisingly enough, I was not celebrated for that.
Well, you're a unique professor, in as much as you actually were teaching the truth, whereas most professors teach a particular thing, and they wouldn't dream of going outside of the boundary, which
remember,
you did.
I mean, I never editorialized. You know,
right.
I wouldn't be professional. My approach was to describe a person or movement or a situation as they understood themselves.
Right.
No one thinks they're the bad guy. You can't just immediately say, you know, Hitler was evil or Lenin was evil. I mean, you have to understand what they thought they were doing. And that I always thought was really the purpose of a historian anyway. You know, the slave owners in the American South, did they think they were evil? No. They thought they were doing a good thing. Well, how did they, and this is what I did. And there was, you know, there was no advocacy one way or the other. But even, mentioning this, even talking about the Versailles Treaty and how Hitler came to power pretty much on the backs of that disastrous treaty. That was sufficient to get people complaining.
Mm-hmm.
And students loved it, though. Students, you know, when I say I was the most popular professor, I'm not kidding. When I got fired from Mount St. Mary's, there was a protest of 181 students, mostly female, about a third black, saying, you know, this is ridiculous. He's done nothing wrong. To this day, I don't know why I was fired. I mean, we know the real reason, but, you know, they never really gave an official reason. So, you know, but thank God I have generous listeners, that I've been able to make a living doing this and translating and writing and doing, you know, papers for different organizations on our side once in a while. So I've been able to make it work.
And thank goodness you have. Because I think people really want the truth, but, as with so many people, If a person believes that they have the truth, they are not going to go looking for it. And I think that even in the so-called alternative media, there are many people who think they know what they're talking about, when in fact they are in error on certain things, as I was when I first began writing on the internet back in 2005, and I have had to go back and make notations saying I was wrong about this, and I think you have to be willing to look at what you've believed and then recognize when the truth hits you
No movement can function without humility. My first book, The Third Rome, Tsarism, Russian Orthodoxy, you know, I was 29 when I wrote that. I was angry when I wrote that. And I stand by it, but I've done numerous radio shows and articles, you know, correcting or reinterpreting parts of it. Because, you know, when you're young, you know, you say when you get older and wiser, you're not gonna agree with the same things. That's just normal, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Sure. Alrighty, we are going to a quick 3-minute break, and we'll be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
Alrighty. Welcome back. Deanna, and we have our guest today, Dr. Matthew Johnson. His website is rusjournal.org. And anyway, we're talking about the fact that sometimes people don't recognize the truth when it hits them, but I believe that people want the truth. Of course they want the truth, but so many people are programmed and they don't understand that they're programmed, and it's kind of a shame. And it's easy, I believe, because when you consider who runs the schools, who runs the colleges, as you're well aware of, and who runs the media in this country, as well as big, industries, then there's reason why so many people are programmed and don't recognize the truth until they actually come to grips with it. Usually it happens if there's a crisis.
That's right.
And then all of a sudden, okay, go ahead.
No, I'm just agreeing with you. You're absolutely right. It usually takes a break. You know, the original Greek for crisis is judgment. You know, people, one of the hardest lessons I ever had to learn, Deanna, is that people would rather hear what they want to hear rather than the truth, that the truth that we preach is hard. People would have to change their entire lives, all of their social contacts, everything, if they were to agree with us. They knew that they would have to suffer, that they would be ridiculed, they might lose their job, they'll be called names, they could be physically assaulted. You know, I mean, I lost mine, purely for ideological reasons. So the fact is that, you know, truth, self-interest seems to rule far more than any abstract desires for facts. And, you know, you come out of grad school and you're researching, and all you're doing, you're building arguments and citations and truth and logic. And you realize that when you talk to people, truth might not necessarily be an important category in their life. They want to believe what makes their life easier, what juxtaposes better with what they already believe. And there's nothing more dangerous than to go to somebody who buys into the system and calmly and slowly destroy their worldview. Bursting the bubble of one of these people can be dangerous. Because how many times, my experience happened many times, where you're debating with somebody, you win, they come to agree with you. Well, I never thought about it that way. and you hear him a day later saying the same crap again.
Right.
This happens all the time. But I do believe truth, finding the absolute truth of things isn't that hard. I think a few conditions have to exist. Number one, you have to get rid of self-interest. You have to not care where your conclusions, where your logic is going to go. You can't have anything that's going to stop the progression. Self-interest is, and we're all guilty of it. You know, cherry picking, all this stuff. We're all guilty of it. Number two, you have to be humble. Number three, you have to work very, very hard. Number four, you have to know where to go. You have to know what text to look at and methods of interpretation that makes sense. If you have that, and I think I do, personally, truth is laid bare. Unfortunately, it's a truth that gets get into a lot of trouble. And we've all suffered because of this. So the facts aren't the issue. Their self-interest is the issue, in my opinion.
I think you're right, because there are doctors who belong to the American Medical Association, and if, which is a labor union, and if they go against the standard of care, they could lose their license. If you're a journalist and you say the wrong thing, you can lose your job. If you're a professor and you teach a curriculum that is not conducive to the general belief system, then you can lose your job, as you've done. Or you can suffer personal injury. Now, I have interviewed several people on this program over the years since I started, and many of them have just sort of faded into the background because of the physical threats that were made against their lives, or because they simply could not handle what was happening to them. If people are younger and they're just getting started, then you cannot afford to throw away the possibility of obtaining an education because of what you believe, or if your family is threatened, or as you say, you lose when you start talking about the truth, or when you go against something that you've believed in for a very long time, and you've built your whole social structure around that, and then all of a sudden you say, wait a minute, I don't think this is true anymore, and give numerous reasons why not, all of a sudden you've lost your entire social body, and it can be really difficult, but if you can no longer embrace something that you know for certain is a lie, and you are dwindling in self-doubt, and you're uncomfortable, and you just can't do it anymore, you have to break, even if it costs you the majority of your friends and associates. And even family members.
Yeah, you've hit on one of the most important, if not the most important issue that our people have to deal with. And that you're going to suffer. If you try to be anonymous, they'll find out who you are. One of our people on Radio Aryan has just been doxxed by the Huffington Post. And you know, I've been using my real name, my address is online, my license plate number is online, I don't give a damn. I have Barnes Review stuff in my my CV, you know, I never hid from it, but that comes at a price. I can't be doxxed at all. But now the way I got through grad school, and people have asked me this many times, is that I'm a nice guy. And I was very friendly and very deferential. So by the time these people figured out that I wasn't on the mainstream, they weren't that upset with me. Oh, that's Matt. He's just crazy. don't worry about it. Yeah, always says that. You know, that kind of, rather than he's a threat.
Right.
And if...
Well, you weren't at the time. Maybe.
What do you mean? Not a threat at the time? Well, you know, the...
You were a nice guy and people didn't see you as a threat.
Personally speaking.
You're right. They saw you as a nice guy, and they just figured, oh, he's just a little different. Let's just go along with him. And
that's right.
Yes.
And that's how I did it. that's how I did it, you know, but they knew I was good. And I was, you know, my first semester teaching, I was 24. I got the University Parents Association Teaching Award. So, you know, there's not a whole lot they can do with that. And, because I spoke to them, you know, I was very pleasant and very agreeable and listened to what they had to say. I didn't go, you know, Zieg Heil on the first day, mm-hmm. like some of our idiots do, and wonder why they're getting thrown out of places. You know, you don't call names, you don't use vulgar, phrases.
Right.
Don't, you know, there's just some nasty, our people put stuff on Facebook and they wonder why they get kicked off, and I kick them off.
Sure.
And because I write and speak in an academic way, I don't think I'm an easy target for a lot of our enemies. I mean, there's plenty of articles out there on me from the SPLC and everything else, but, mm-hmm. But I made a decision, as you mentioned, I made a decision in 1990. Right when, 1989, Christmas Day, 1989, Nicolae Ceaușescu was executed by his own soldiers. And that was the moment. I remember it like it was yesterday. But I said, this is what I'm going to do. Because a few days before, no one believed the Soviet Union was going to collapse. It was this huge colossus. And then overnight, it falls to pieces. There was no war, no big battle, no economic depression, nothing. It just fell apart. And I said, I was a musician at the time. And I said, oh no, this is what I'm going to do. And looking at Ceaușescu's body there, I made a decision. I looked over to my sister and I said, I know what I'm going to do with my life. So I knew this was going to be a problem. I knew it was going to be a struggle. And I said, even then, I can't allow self-interest or jealousy or anger or any emotion like that to get into the way of any research I do. Special pleading is awful. And university professors and journalists especially live in fear. Those jobs are very easy. They're very cushy. There's a lot of money there and prestige, but they're also very rare. They're shrinking. And so people who have those jobs will do anything to keep them. I've had professors out after a couple of beers tell me that, of course you're right, man, on such and such an issue, but I'm not going to destroy my career over it. And it's really hard to argue with them on that. And I think this is a case in a lot of places. University professor has a very easy job. You know, you're talking about things that you know. Most of your things are done for you. Your research is done by students. No one wants to lose that. You're making six figures in most state universities. So maybe a half dozen times I've heard the phrase, yes, you're right, but I'm not going to risk my career over it.
Right. And I think that is what a lot of people say. But I remember a few years back, this is so funny when I think about it, somebody was making this accusations against me, and they said, even her name is made up. Spin is her goal. And they said that they could tell by the shape of my ear or some dumb thing that I was really somebody else and this was just a made up name. But Spingola, that's my married name, and it's a very common name in Italy, and it was just so stupid. But there were people that actually believe this. They actually believe this crazy person that was saying this. So I guess there are some people who are looking for conspiracies and use conspiracy theories to try to get rid of us or eliminate us or make us look ridiculous, when in fact they just make themselves look ridiculous. Because when you come up with the facts and the figures and the real truth and they try to discredit that, it's so funny. I just find it really kind of funny.
Well, it is, and I know I have not come across that spin trying to analyze your name. That's pretty hilarious.
But, isn't it funny?
But I've heard about it with other people too, and my view of the matter is that our people really are an oppressed class. And
yes.
Whenever they get a chance, you know, they're going to let off some steam. This is one of the reasons alcoholism is such a huge problem in our movement.
Oh, really?
Oh, of course, yeah. I've been active on the street level since late 89, early 1990. And, yeah, for the young men, it is a problem. And, just general immaturity and the kind of know-it-all attitude, symbol over substance and all that. You know, it's, our people aren't heard. They don't really have a forum where anyone pays any attention to them. You're driven from academia, you're driven from journalism, and this is what you get. This kind of, you know, temper tantrum is what happens. So, you know, pity those people rather than be angry at them. God knows what they've been through. I've always said that I define a brother or a sister or a friend as anybody who has a very good chance of sharing a gulag cell with me. I think that's the case, then they're my brother and I'll do anything for them. That's how we have to think.
Sure.
And you don't have to agree on every little thing either.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that that's a very important, issue. Because there are people that I agree on them, with them on numerous things. But if you have a disagreement with somebody over something that they believe, you should stick to that belief, not attack the character right. of the person who believes it. Just state that you disagree on an issue, because you may have to work with that person later on, or he or she may be a very good friend, and you never want to go after a person's character. But just go after the issue, because that's really what's important. You don't want to discredit a person's character.
Right, now, they're not just wrong, they're infiltrators, and they're demonic, and they're sick.
Right, that's ridiculous.
And it happens all the time. And a part of the problem is, you know, we don't have a lot of intellectuals. We don't have a lot of people who know how to build an argument. I think we take for granted sometimes. We do it all the time. But building a serious historical political argument takes years. It's a lot of work. Logic can be very, very difficult. You have to make certain that every avenue of escape is sealed off. You have to do a lot of work. And most of our people, good people, aren't really capable of that. And so emotion and anger and feeling, especially self-interest, gets in the way. You add alcohol or jealousy over women, which does show its head once in a while with us. It can be a disaster. As of right now, as of early 2019, we have no institution. We have no substantial presence institutionally in this society. And I just did an interview yesterday on Donald Trump, the State of the Union. You know, regardless of what we may think about him, he's all alone.
He is absolutely all alone.
He doesn't have his party. He doesn't have, certainly doesn't have the Democrats, not the Republicans, not the Heritage Foundation, not the Cato, you know, he's all by himself. And that's because we don't have the maturity or the money or the ability to create lasting institutions. And there's a lot of rich people on our side out there, but they're not going to give money unless they see an institution that stands the test of time. And the last one, of course, was Willis Cardo's Liberty Lobby, where I was hired in 1999, and he gave me my start. And that was the last one.
Yes, and he was a nationalist. And so many people have used that, have disfigured that word to the point that it has become something evil, when in fact it isn't. A nationalist is just somebody that believes in their country and believes that their country should be distinct and have protection and, it's just the exact opposite of being a globalist. And globalism is certainly on the rise with all of the wealth of multiculturalism. And we'll be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. Our guest today is Dr. Matthew Johnson. His website is rusjournal.org. That's rusjournal.org. And we're talking about, a lot of things, and certainly about not going after people just because of an issue. Or not going after a person's character because they have a different belief than you do about a particular thing. At the end of your acknowledgments, you said, in your latest work that will be published in the Barnes Review, and you were talking about Willis Cardo, which of course brought up the word nationalism, but you said you signed off July 17th, 2018, and mentioned that that is 100th anniversary of the murder of the Russian royal family. And I thank you for mentioning that. There have been so many people slaughtered, and first you have to destroy the institution of something, as you mentioned before, that you have to destroy what people have come to believe in, and institutions that are really in favor of their people and who attempt to make life better for the people that they are serving rather than the people they're exploiting.
Well, I'm Russian Orthodox, as you know. I'm a member of the clergy. I'm a convert. I converted back in graduate school, and Tsar Nicholas II was one of the reasons. He technically would be the last Roman emperor, descending from Constantine in Byzantium. And at the time of his, but he never abdicated. That's a myth.
Right.
That's a forgery. Was never signed. It's not in the proper, it actually had to be handwritten according to law, but it wasn't. It was done on a typewriter. Like a lot of great leaders, he was surrounded by traitors. And there's so much, you know, I do have a book out on the subject. I published it, as I was writing that, on the nature of the murder, the ritualistic aspects of it, the fact that these, the scrawlings on the wall have been found in Israel as well, in assassinations there, you know, different context, but it's a formula. And they knew exactly what they were doing. This was a Jewish ritual murder, because they feared the popularity of Tsar Nicholas. You know, when when World War I began, 98% of Russian land that was farmable, arable, was in the hands of the peasantry. Russian taxes were the lowest in the world. Russian economy was booming. They had just discovered oil in the Caucasus, which is what got England very upset. As soon as the Soviets exploded, the Rockefellers and Rothschilds took over those fields. Their savings rate was going through the roof. Their population growth was going through the roof. They had a huge trade surplus. In fact, they were almost completely self-sufficient. They were feeding much of the world. They had a great degree of equality. When you have peasantry owning the land, either communally or individually, the church was getting stronger and stronger. And so, you know, there was no censorship under Tsar Nicholas, except when the war started, contrary to myth. And the Jewish press there knew that they couldn't attack him, so they created this myth of Rasputin, who is, you know, is beyond, you know, what we think we know about Rasputin is mostly nonsense. And the proof of this is the, I have an essay in my latest book on the, Extraordinary Commission, which the white government or the Kerensky government put together to investigate corruption in the Tsarist regime, and they found nothing. Now here you have people who have every motive to try to justify their revolution, and they found absolutely nothing, including on Rasputin. And so Rasputin was kind of invented. I mean, he was a real person, but they invented this character because it was the only way to really attack the royal family without attacking the royal family directly. And of course, the Germans were, unfortunately, you know, they should never have been enemies, but were involved in some of this nonsense as well. And when Tsar Nicholas took over the Russian front in 1915, that's when the Russian army had its greatest breakthroughs. And Germany was completely exhausted in a short time. Most of the truth is, Deanna, and I, you know, it depresses me every time I say this, but you take the average educated American everything he thinks he knows about the world or history is a lie. And we're at a point now where we don't even have the same language anymore to discuss things. You know, the old myth that Russia, there was one rifle for five guys and all that, that was nonsense. There were supply problems because no one had any idea how bloody this war would be, but all countries had supply problems. It was taken care of in a very short time. Believe it or not, the Russian economy grew during the war. Vodka sales were banned. You know, and it's to the point where, you know, the frustration gets so great. I just, you know, my biggest weakness in debate often is that I get angry because these people, you know, what they believe is so nonsensical that I can't imagine how they can't grasp it of themselves, even logically. So, you know, this is the problem that we all have. It's a problem that you have, a problem that we all have. And, you've been able to maintain a pleasant personality. I wish I could say the same. But, it's one of the reasons I'm writing on this. One of the reasons I'm interested in it, is to right these wrongs. And I said I was angry when I wrote my first book. It was because I could, you know, every syllable, of the average history and of Russia is nothing but storytelling. And I taught myself the language, at least how to read it. And, you know, this has been my life ever since. It's a struggle, but I wouldn't give it up for anything.
I don't think I would either. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty happy. No, I'm happy. I'm a happy individual. And, I think that the truth is important. It's amazing. I was just going through your article about Rasputin, and one of your sources, Platonov. I used Oleg Platonov in a piece that I did, which was titled "Rothschilds in World War II France," and he was. I think it's interesting. Well, we both appreciate this gentleman's work.
Absolutely.
And he was a contemporary writer. And I believe that I probably included this in my book, the second book. But anyway, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, Platonov is the chairman of the Encyclopedia of Russian Civilization, which is an ongoing project. When I was at the Barnes Review, he invited me and Michael Collins Piper to go to Russia for that famous Holocaust conference.
Yes.
My passport was denied.
Wow. Actually, I wrote this chapter, but I didn't use it. But anyway, yes. Mike Piper went there. But your passport was denied?
Yeah, it's not the first time. You know, once people got wind, because I didn't have one at the time. They all had theirs already. So I applied, and this conference was kind of a big deal. And so, it was a huge disappointment. I was supposed to speak at the old KGB building of all places. And, but Michael did a great job. Of course, Michael Collins Piper and I were very close friends.
As Michael would, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
I miss him very much. He didn't die from any foul play.
No.
No, he didn't take care of himself, unfortunately, and I talked to him about that. I have the Friends of Michael Collins Piper thing on Facebook, which I founded, because I, you know, we were very close friends. Every year on my ex-wife's birthday, he would call and sing her happy birthday because he had this huge, booming Jackie Gleason voice. It was just a thing we used to do. So, that was, you know, and so Platonov, he liked Stalin a bit too much for me. But, you know, he doesn't, as far as I know, there's nothing of his in English, but, I'm good enough at this point where I can read it. But other than the Stalin thing, you have in Russia, you have, you know, national Bolsheviks. You have people who, are pretty much national socialists on most things, except they think that they think that Stalin was one of them. And of course, I have a chapter in there saying that Stalin was not an anti-Semite. He was not a nationalist. He was no different than Trotsky or Lenin in terms of ideology or policy. He just had a different context. So I disagree with him on that, but like we were saying, you know, so what? You know, that's not a big deal. No one's perfect.
Right.
Not even me, believe it or not. And so yeah, he's I don't know, I guess my passport, I don't remember if there was even a reason. This is a long time ago. Was it 2000, 2001?
Wow.
David Duke went. So yeah, this is, you know, and I wasn't too surprised, but everyone had their passports already. For some strange reason, I didn't have one. So I haven't flown since 9/11, not because of any fears, because I don't want to deal with airports and I hate flying. But, so yeah, that was a big disappointment, but yes, Platonov did invite me to that. And the Encyclopedia of Russian Civilization is a huge, it's a gold mine. If you can read the language, a gold mine of revisionist information. So some people say, you know, machine translations are a problem. They're good for Romance languages, but when it has to transliterate too, it's a problem.
Right.
And that's why I do it sometimes when I'm lazy, but I realize that no, it's just, you know, you can end up sounding like a halfwit, trying to use this stuff. And it's worse, the more obscure the language gets, the worse the machine translation gets.
Right.
So it's good for Spanish and French, but that's it. Unfortunately, so I had to teach myself. When my first son was born, every word that he learned in English, I learned the Russian word, and then I taught him.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's how I learned.
I can't imagine.
That was fun. But then of course his vocabulary exploded and I couldn't keep up, but when it first started, so he knows the language as much as I do. I can't speak it, but, because, you know, I don't even know how some of these things are pronounced. It's like the
Yes, my pronunciation. Now you say Platonov, how do you say it?
Platonov. Yeah, usually three syllables, the middle syllable is usually the one that's stressed.
Platonov. Okay, now he wrote Russia's Crown of Thorns, The Secret History of Freemasonry, 1731 to 1996. And people accused him or describe him as being an ultra-nationalist, an anti-Semitic, and a Holocaust denier. So, anyway.
Well, people throw that, you know, that's why, you know, we're going to be accused of this stuff all the time. But the thing is, anyone to the right of Trotsky gets this thrown at them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's meaningless these days. Words like racism, they don't have any definitions. You mentioned people condemning nationalism. You know how many times I've been in a debate with somebody, they define nationalism in the most negative possible way to suit themselves, and then pat themselves on the back and they condemn it?
Yes.
But no, it has an actual definition. Please, let's use it. But it, you know, cutting through the mythology is, and you know, our jobs are not simple. We see information, we see how it's packaged, whether it be in the press or in the universities. Our job is to rip the packaging off and to see what's beneath, to take the mask off and see what that is the historian's job. That has always been the historian's job. And there's like maybe seven of us in the world who actually are doing it. And if you do your job properly, you won't be able to teach in academia. And it's not because you get up there and start talking like Alfred Rosenberg. It's because, you know, you're asking all the wrong questions, which by the way is a direct quote. Asking the wrong questions.
Right. Well, what could possibly be the wrong question? That's pretty funny.
But you know, I survived, and our people need to know this. You know, I had two little kids at the time. It was a horrible time. But you know, my wife had to work full time. I eventually got myself back on my feet again, but, you know, we survived. If the family is strong, if your faith is strong, you'll get by it. It's not the worst thing that can, that's going to happen to pretty much all of us at one time or another. Those who don't use their real name, they're going to get doxxed. And remember, it's not the end of the world. You will survive it. If I could survive it, you guys can survive it. And it's been a big issue at Radio Aryan, and it's a continuing issue. There's going to be a point where we can't hide behind pseudonyms anymore. And it's a shame, but that's how it's going to be. But it's not the end of the world when that happens. If I can do it, anyone can do it.
And you sacrificed quite a lot, given the things that you presented in your acknowledgments. And I'm sorry that that happened. It's the loss was undoubtedly a very severe, and you got sick. And speaking of illness, you mentioned that you had been ill, and I've been doing a lot of reading on various topics lately, and a woman by the name of Carolyn Miss, M-Y-S-S, made a statement that I think is very applicable here, and that is your biography is your biology. And we often, when something dreadful happens to us, we're under a great deal of stress, our body is going to get sick. In fact, 95% of all illnesses are due to stress. And so you indicated that you had not been feeling well, and you've been under a lot of people in this country have been under a great deal of stress because of the weather, because of the losses due to the weather and other seemingly natural circumstances. But anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out.
Well, no, I appreciate that. You know, I'm an empath as well. And empaths have a tendency to attract narcissists. And unfortunately,
that's
almost a universal constant.
Really?
For some reason. And I suffered with it, textbook. And, you know, going through the divorce in 2014 was the worst thing that ever happened to me. Not so much because of her, but because of, you know, the children. The kids were teenagers. They weren't babies, but, you know, they sided with me. It was very, very clear what the problem was. I didn't want them to choose sides, but she forced them to. And, but I survived. I got through it. She had to pay me, quite a bit of money back then to get rid of me. So I kind of go to the extent you could win a divorce. I wanted, and one of the reasons I did so well with the litigation, because I insisted we go in front of a judge, was that I fired my lawyer. And I did everything pro se.
Oh.
So she's bleeding white, paying an expensive attorney, and I'm by myself. And, you know, who knows your family better than you do? So, you know, but I dropped out of, I mean, I was writing, but I dropped out of activism for a while, and it was Matthew Heinbeck and Matt Parrott that contacted me saying, you need to get back into this again. We'll give you a website. We'll give you whatever you need to get started again. I said, who the hell is this? And they said, oh, well, we have this little group called Traditionalist Workers Party. We're big fans of yours. Please, get back on the air again. And that was in, 2015. And I said, all right. And so they lit the fire under me to get me going again. So, the site and, being connected with Sven Longshanks at Radio Aryan, which used to be part of Daily Stormer. That was all done by them.
And wow.
So I lost everything. I lost so much back then, but then I gained my fans, followers, supporters. I've met a lot of movement people out here, and they've taken care of me. Like, for example, in Charlottesville, I was hit by a chemical attack from Antifa, and I was blind for 3 days.
Oh, my gosh.
You didn't know that?
No, I did not know that.
And I went down, and I'm kind of an elder statesman to a lot of the guys there. They formed a protective cordon around me to make sure that no one else got to me while I was, you know, because there was bear mace. It was a gel that's designed to stick to the cornea.
Wow.
So I had to go to the hospital and everything else. It was worth it. It was worth every second of it. But that was quite uncomfortable.
Yes.
But I saw, you know, and that happened, and these other guys who've gone to jail for allegedly, you know, hurting people. Antifa has been attacking us for decades. They came to that thing threatening to kill us, and we defended ourselves. And, you know, the press hasn't been too interested in my story. You know, the point is that the brotherhood, you know, was there. My son was there as well, and he was a medic because he was a lifeguard.
Oh.
Under fire, this kid didn't flinch. He must have helped about 100 of our guys. We had 2,500 guys there. The biggest.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Oh yeah. We outnumbered them all the time. Of course, those days are over now.
Yes.
But he with this, you know, he went from guy to guy, was helping with the chemicals, really brought us down and knocked out half our guys. And, he didn't flinch. They're still talking about him. He was just a young guy at the time, but So, you know, there are, I mean, you say you're happy. I think the word is we're content.
You right.
know?
Right.
What, Deanna, let me ask you, what would you, if the world were sane, if the U.S. were, a relatively healthy society, what would you be doing?
Gosh. What would I be doing? I would be writing about something else.
So you'd still be a writer.
Yes, I would still be a writer because I love books. I absolutely love books. They are my very favorite method of learning things. And I have a huge library, and I also belong to an entity called Questia, where I can I have a subscription to Questia. I have had for a number of years, where you don't have to buy all the books that you look at or that you read. They have a huge collection of books that you can read and add them to your collection and categorize them. And then I have a lot of books on Kindle. I think I'm up to like 400 books on Kindle. Pretty close to 400. Plus the regular hard stuff that I have. But I would still be writing. It would just be about a different topic, a different something. You said something that I hadn't thought of. You said that empaths are naturally attracted to narcissistic people.
Or that we attract narcissistic people, yeah.
Why? Oh, because we're so empathetic. And
we can see red flags. You know, I look back now and the red flags were bright neon signs. But I didn't see, I made excuses.
That's right.
This is so common. We try to, you know, she went through such and such as a girl and you know, I made every excuse possible. And we get, you know, in general, I mean, I've heard it so many times. That we, you know, being an empath is awful, you know, because we want to fix people, you know, everything else. Anyway, I didn't mean to put you on the spot there, but.
No, and we're always, we don't fix ourselves sometimes, because we're so busy helping, right. Not fixing, but helping or assisting or, yeah.
And that's taken as weakness. That's taken as, that you'd be taking advantage of.
A pushover. Yeah.
But speaking of books, you know, one of the biggest things, the biggest problems I have with a lot of people, not just on our side, but in general is we live in an era of, you know, general relativism. And if truth in most things is relative, then why would you ever study anything? Why would you ever put the effort in to learn about something if it doesn't matter? If truth is relative. And I try to tell the young guys, you mentioned all your books. I said, you take a small issue area in politics, say, I don't know, Social Security or Medicare, it would take you probably a decade to get through all the written material on that, to master it, to know the policy, where it comes from, all the legal decisions, everything else. Just on that tiny little area, it would take you a very long time to master the literature. You know, and I've done that in my field, and I get angry when someone who doesn't know anything or wouldn't even know how to do anything wants to lecture me on it. You don't even know where to go. No, don't know the facts. You don't know where to go to find the facts.
Exactly.
It's sin to me.
Yes.
So we have to specialize. And, you know, when you specialize, you realize that when you get deeper into a subject matter, just how wrong most people are. The deeper and deeper you get, you realize, and you know, and it's going to take, it's a lifetime of work. It's Russia stuff with me. It's a million lifetimes of work. Just on that. And people just need to be humble and realize that, you know, unless you've gone through this amount of work, we really don't know anything. But that's hard to tell somebody without sounding like a jerk. So what do you do? So now I don't care. I just tell them anyways.
Sure.
And come off sounding arrogant that way. But you know, you put the work in, politics, political science, international, political economy, these are technical fields.
Right.
There are thousands of papers published, every week, academic papers.
Right.
You know, we have to master. And it's a lot of work, and people need to know.
It is a lot of work. Okay, we're going to a 3-minute break. We'll be right back.
It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good.
All righty, we are back. We are back with our today, Dr. Matthew Johnson. His website is rusjournal.org. I just want to tell one little quick thing. When I was 14, I was living in Sacramento, California, grew up in California, and I always used to take the bus downtown, and I had a favorite shop that I used to go to, and I found a first edition of Anna Karenina. And I can never say that, her second name, Karenina, Anna Karenina. And I was looking for it the other day. I know it's on one of my bookshelves, but anyway, I just thought I would share that. So my fascination with Russia began pretty early. But let's get into your book. Let's get into your latest work.
Well, I still can't remember if this is my ninth, eighth, whatever book it is. My book on Vladimir Putin is actually my bestseller. I do have a book on Russian literature, actually, from quite a while ago. Everything has been on Russian history and Soviet history has been my entire career. And I realized that, you need to be able to read the language to do it. Because when you learn, it's so much is censored, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
So much is said, it's not the government, private sector is doing all the censoring. Publishers and everything else. Tech companies. There's a whole new world out there. My ideological view was so, just ripped wide open. Because now I could read these guys that Americans have never heard of before. Oleg Platonov being one. And what's taken for granted there in Russia today, anti-Jewish thing that's mainstream. That's a normal, they say that on the floor of the Duma. I mean, it's not, here it's on the margins, but there, I remember the story when the CIA was putting together the Democratic Coalition in Ukraine back in 2004, and they had all the parties together, and all the liberal parties together, which total probably could poll about 7%, 7-8%. And the CIA guy or USAID guy said, okay, I want you guys to reduce your platform to one small page, just for the voters can read it and understand. And it took a while for them to do that because they were very different parties. And it's a true story. And the US CIA guy got the platform. It was one sentence. It was to deport the Jews to Israel. Now, these are liberal parties. It's just something that is so common and ordinary there. And people don't understand that. I've done a podcast, I've done radio shows, I've an article out on the so-called Holocaust denial law, which does not exist in Russia. There is a law against extremism, but Roman Ushkov was just acquitted because the Shabbat sect in Perm, the Urals, tried to use this law against the defamation of the Russian state, so to speak, which was a Medvedev law, that, anti-Semitism should be illegal. And he had mentioned, talking about Nuremberg, what a fraud it was and all this stuff. And, he was acquitted. And it was very clear the judiciary, with the support of the state, said there is nothing in actual legitimate historical scholarship that could be banned by the state or even by the private sector. So that's something I wanted to get out of the way right away. There is no Holocaust denial law in Russia. It is a day-to-day normal thing to deny Jewish claims there. In America, Jews go to the president as his, or politicians in general, as their masters. In Russia, they go to Putin because they're worried. They go as suppliants. He's the most popular man, one of the most popular men in the world, certainly the most popular man in Russia. They realize they have to watch themselves. And I think the big difference, and it kind of sums up a lot of what I've been doing recently, in the Western world, organized capital controls politicians. the banks finance our debt, and the government couldn't function for 2 minutes without the banks. So clearly, private capital is far more powerful than the state. That is not the case in the East. In Russia, China, Belarus, the state is more powerful than capital. I don't know if you've ever seen the YouTube video of Putin coming into Oleg Deripaska's boardroom meeting. He's one of these Jewish oligarchs, big aluminum firm, was going to leave and leave Russia and open up in Central Asia for cheaper wages. And he went in there, sat at the head of the table, and forced everyone to sign a contract saying that they would never leave Russia. And just to show his superiority, when Oleg Deripaska, again, the guy's worth like $50 billion, signed, like a little kid, Putin says, "Give me back my pen." Just as a way to jab him one last time, showing him who matters. He's done this. There was a medical supply firm that was accused of selling defective products, which could be very dangerous. Right, talk about it later.
Welcome back. Our guest, Dr. Matthew Johnson. His website is rusjournal.org. And we've all heard negative things recently it's been how Russia colluded with Trump in the election. And I think this is so ridiculous, given the number of elections that the U.S. has taken over in other countries. It just makes me sick.
But you know, it's a backhanded compliment to Putin, because you know, 1997, Russia was disappearing.
Right,
the military had fallen apart. There was no economy. It couldn't pay its debts. And here, just you know, a few years later, because of one man, they're now this powerful that they can control elections. Of course, you know, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever, I think in my career, 30 years now, it's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. These people control the universities and the newspapers, and this is what they come up with? And, you know, and it's absurd on so many levels, I don't even know where to begin. The claim, and I've read the NSA report on this, it has nothing to do with coming into any computer. We say hacking, usually you think of breaking into a computer, bypassing security system, etc. But that's not what it is. The thing is that there's too many pro-Russian media outlets in America. And they had a tendency to be anti-Clinton. That was the whole thing. It was that, you know, you have Russian-owned media in America. That was the problem. That's what hacking is. They didn't say anything about computers. The closest thing they ever got was in the Democratic National Committee, where Hillary Clinton tried to, you know, use that Russia argument during the primary. Mm-hmm. But it has nothing to do with the general election.
And she should talk.
Right. Well, you know, what was happening with the DNC is that she was, she created a situation where if you donated money to the DNC, it was funneled to her.
Right.
It's two very different things. And Democrats weren't too happy with her. They wanted Bernie. I think a lot of them wanted Bernie. I certainly respect him more than I do Hillary. And you know, they were going to stay home. They didn't want Hillary. And that was where the fraud clearly came from her. Most Democrats were aware of it. And Bernie supporters certainly know that. So the Russia story was a way to cover that over. You know, I discovered a law of social science. I named it after myself. It's called Johnson's Law. Johnson's Law says this: the more obscure a country or an issue, the farther it is away from our day-to-day experience, the more the press can lie about it. Either they're lying deliberately, or they just don't know anything, because there's so few people to correct them, they know they can get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Russia is, and this is a law, you know, it's absolutely true. Because Russia, most people don't know the first thing about the country, They can pretty much say anything, and there's not a lot of people who are going to correct them on it. I mean, North Korea is the most extreme issue. No one knows anything what's happening there. There's no communication. So all these documentaries and stuff like that are, you know, they're extrapolations. They're speculation. But Johnson's Law, you know, I see it every day. And it's because no one knows the first thing about Russian politics or Russian history, that becomes the boogeyman. Remember, when the USSR existed, there were no sanctions on that country. The USA traded with the Soviet Union from the day it was founded to the day it fell, including high-tech issues. We were training Russian scientists. We were training them in weapon systems. I mean, you know, Anthony Sutton has been through this in volume after volume after volume.
Right.
There was no, you know, the Cold War is largely mythical. The empire got too big, that's for sure. But that has nothing to do with Bolshevism, which most people in government couldn't define if their lives depended on. The Cold War is largely mythical. Only when a nationalist gets into power, now Russia's the root of all evil. This is completely different. No Soviet dictator was ever treated as badly as Putin, who's not a dictator. So people referring to this as a new Cold War, there wasn't an old one. The U.S. was not opposed to Bolshevism or Marxism in any way, shape, manner, or form. They were opposed to the Russian Empire getting so big that they could have trading deals to keep the Americans out. That might be a problem. But ideologically or diplomatically, there was no issue there. The U.S. traded and spent a fortune in that country. Part of my book explains at length, which Anthony Sutton has done far better than me, the U.S. and Western Europe built the USSR. There could be no question about this. Anthony Sutton has the internal documents from the companies that did it. Henry Ford built their first truck plant in eastern Ukraine in 1936, I think, in Kharkiv, and created the entire automotive industry came from that. GE laid out their electrical grid. The Rockefellers, their oil. There's a mining company from Alaska. They're huge mining in the Urals. By the end of the Civil War in Russia, their intellectuals, their engineers were either dead, underground, in prison, or exiled. But they sent an army of new people to the U.S. to be trained, and they came back and ran the economy. So the Cold War, you know, that's not an enemy. The only enemy, all of a sudden, Putin, a nationalist, an orthodox man, comes to power, all of a sudden, Russia is now evil. All of a sudden, the KGB is terrible in the minds of people who were apologizing for it years ago. So,
right. And that's one of the things that you hear is that, oh, but he was a former member of the KGB. Well, so was George H.W. Bush. He was, in fact, the head of the CIA, which is a corollary to the KGB. And nobody says, oh, gosh, George H.W. Bush was this and this. And speaking of the Bushes, did they have something to do with the takedown of Russia? And didn't they profit? Didn't they profit militarily? There was some Project Hammer program that they invested, and there was also the several companies in the United States profited when Russia supposedly fell. Like Halliburton was there, and they took over certain oil companies and whatnot. Isn't that right?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, by the 1970s, the Soviet economy was spent. The capital was getting old. It was depreciating rapidly. This is why the Jews wanted to leave, and the whole Jackson-Vanik Amendment issue came up and go to Israel. There was no more profit to be made. They never made the ship heavy industry to light industry. And you had a huge bureaucracy that wanted the heavy industry to be dominant, but didn't have the money to retool all of the capital, all the infrastructure. And so we could see that was creaking. Now, no one in the West said that, but now we know this. And, you know, the ideology was failing. You know, people went into the KGB at the time because they were patriots, so-called Soviet patriots. People didn't know the first thing about Marxism. Marxism is only important in American universities. That's pretty much it. These people didn't know a damn thing. They were Russians. And they saw their jobs as support. And this is something that Americans need to realize, this national Bolshevik movement, where you have people who talk just like us, except there's a hammer and sickle on the newspaper headline. And it might throw you for a little bit. What the hell's the matter? But remember, they see that as a national signal, symbol, not a Marxist one. They see it as a national, that's what Platonov was, one of these guys that Stalin was the Russian Hitler, which is not true, but it throws people. The Communist Party, the Soviet Union today, I'm sorry, the Communist Party of the Russian Federation today is a national socialist, is a pan-Slavic party. It's one of the most conservative parties in the country.
Wow.
And that shift just was to move from, and again, by the 1970s, no one cared. No one read Marx anymore. You know, under Brezhnev, there was no ideological fervor. So if you were going to join security services, you were doing it because you were a patriot. You know, same thing for members of the army or anything like that.
Okay.
So that's the story. Putin was, and the story I was telling before the break, is connected to this, because the point I was making, that in the West, politicians are controlled by big money. In Russia, Putin is stronger than big money. And he can tell them what to do. And this is why the Russian economy has done so much better than the Americans. The Russian economy is not based on oil. Only about 7% of its GDP comes from oil-related things. Its exports are much higher, but a lot of lazy people want to claim that oil prices dictate the Russian economy, which is not true. And Putin took it from a fourth world backwater, which is what it was in 1998, to the sixth largest economy in the world in, what, 8 years. You know, there's no long-term debt. You have the flat tax, the 13% flat tax. You have a far more conservative in every respect. Of course, the old scars still remain. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, the economy is far more rational than anything in the West. People are far happier than in the West. Not everybody is on antidepressants and Adderall in Russia, unlike the West. And so I've always thought that there was a lot of resentment for him because he's so popular that they would love to have that. And of course, his image is also very, very powerful, and they would love to have that, and they don't. So, you know, Vladimir Putin is one of the great men of our time. And he should be treated that way. And he has been an opponent of Israel. He's armed Iraq before the war, Syria, of course, intervened in Syria, and is now intervening in Venezuela. Because, of course, as you know, the U.S. has ringed that country with bases and allies, overthrown pro-Russian governments in Central Asia, in Georgia, in Ukraine, violently, in 2014. So, you know, that was the point I was trying to make before, but the two systems, really, it's simplistic, but who rules what? The common good, the state is more powerful than capital in Russia. In the U.S., capital or individual ego controls the state. And that's the big difference between the two.
Well, that's interesting. It is also amazing that when some people in the alternative movement saw that Putin was so popular, they thought that somehow that was going to help us. But I don't see how that could be a benefit to us.
Well, I need to make something very, very clear. I was the very first guy to say that Putin was a nationalist back in 2000 when he was first elected. I was working for Willis Cardo. I was attacked by everyone, including them. I was called everything. Oh, he's a communist now, KGB, whatever. I converted Mike Piper and Willis Cardo when they began seeing his policies. They then went out and started converting other people. I was the first one to make it very clear that Putin is anti-globalist, he's a nationalist, he's a Christian, he's one of us in almost every way. Not in every way, but almost every way. I was all alone. So, and trust me, I was all alone. Now, it's taken for granted. And to the point where the regime is angry that Putin didn't want Hillary as president. You know, so I take responsibility for that. I was the first one to do that, and I paid a dear price at the time for it. But some of these people who attacked me back in 2000, now are acting like it never happened. But, you know, I guess I take it as a compliment.
Wow.
That was me.
Now, he has been the president of Russia for how long? Since 98? 96.
New Year's Eve, 1999, 2000, and then of course Medvedev was president for a while. The Russian population was asked, this was about 5 years ago. The question was, if the Constitution had to be violated in order for Putin to be president longer, do you want that? And it's like 75% said yes.
Oh my goodness.
So he's, you know, amongst Russian polls, and these are not just in Russia, but they're in Poland and Ukraine and sometimes hostile countries. His popularity rating rarely goes under 75%. And it goes up and down depending on economic factors, but after the civil war in Ukraine, the Crimea issue, it was over 90%, believe it or not. You had a lot of very, very jealous politicians in the West. And the reason I gave to you before is that the common good rules capital as much as humanly possible in that country. And a country so big is the reason. The economy is simply more rational. We would do better there than here. And I would really be there if I didn't have kids and if my spoken Russian were better. Because everyone who I know there who's emigrated says it's far better in almost every way. It is now... So the left sees the U.S. military as a leftist force to promote globalism, which it is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's a big issue of mine. And so that's, you know, to put it in simplistic terms, that's what makes Putin different in the East. And I think the Chinese have somewhat of a similar situation. But in the Russian case, you know, he embarrasses the West because he is so popular, and he's popular because he rejects the West and threw the IMF out of his country in 2001. And it drives them insane. He paid his debt off early. They didn't want him to do it. They said, oh no, we need that interest. He paid it off anyway. But Moody's still downgraded Russian bonds. He paid the long-term debt off early in 2002 or 3. And Moody's still downgraded his bond. And he paid them off early anyway, then threw the IMF out. Very few people can claim that. So, you know, that's the reason he's popular, because he's delivered the goods. He took a fourth world country and made it into a first world country in 5-8 years. And it's only been done a handful of times. Hitler's done it. Park Chung-hee in South Korea has done it. Chiang Kai-shek in Taiwan has done it. And Putin's done it. That's about it. It's an extraordinary achievement.
Wow. Now, somebody in the chat room wants to know, Matt, did you say Peter the Great was a communist? I don't think you said that.
I would never say that.
No.
Communism didn't exist really ideologically at the time. I did say that his persecution of the church made him a proto-Bolshevik. I did say that.
Oh, okay.
So that's explaining, you know, see how these things get filtered over time, you know?
Sure. Alrighty, we're going to take a quick break, and we will take your phone calls in the next hour at 800-313-9443. Be right back. And his today is Dr. Matthew Johnson. His website is rusjournal.org. And you were talking about all of the good things that Putin has done for Russia. Do you think that he's, and you think that he's the real deal? I have people in, I have a person in Russia that I've communicated with over a period of time that says some of the same people run things in Russia just as they do here.
The same individuals?
No, the same ethnic group.
Well, you know, there's only a handful of Jews left in Russia. They're, I think, you know, 0.1% of the population.
Oh.
Locally, you know, in places like Perm, where I was talking about, groups like Chabad have done very, very well.
Oh, the Chabad Lubavitchers?
Or? Yeah. The real extremist sect. And, you know, the federal government backed the actions against them, concerning the so-called Holocaust denial case. Again, there's no law like that. The extremist law that this was based on has been overturned, but it had nothing to do with the Holocaust anyway.
Oh.
It was the only World War II law that was condemned by the U.S. And of course, you know, Putin's movement was a revolution, but you can't replace every single individual, at every local level. And which is the reason why Putin federalize, and appoint with state legislature opinion, local governors. And that was because the same people were running it there and were essentially putting their own people in charge. And Putin took a lot of heat for that from the West. As it turns out, the West actually said for Yeltsin to do the same thing. So, but the U.S. government was, connected with the Jewish oligarchs and organized crime figures. And there's really no difference between the two, in Russia, right? You know, throughout the 1990s. And in the lawsuit, the federal government against Harvard University, that all came out, which is a whole separate issue. They shut down part of the economics department there because of their extreme corrupt dealings in Russia, and the federal government won. So, you're always going to have, you know, imperfections and all these problems everywhere. It's never going to be perfect. Putin is not a dictator. He's far from perfect, but he's infinitely better than what we have here. But he is most certainly a great man.
Do you see Trump as being a nationalist?
I'm not entirely sure what Trump is doing. You know, I remember when he first hit it big when I was a kid, he was as apolitical as you can get. He's in way over his head. I feel bad for the guy. I think he wanted to be one when he first started, but he's all alone, as we said before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have never seen a man treated by the press like he's been.
And you have to ask why, for certain.
Alrighty.
My goodness. Okay, we're at the top of the hour, and we do have some callers lining up. So, anyway, we'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Dr. Matthew Johnson, and his website is rusjournal.org. A question from the chat room. Let's see, where is that question? Oh, not from the chat room, but from email. The question is that this individual has been hearing recently that homosexuals are being harassed, beaten, etc. by the Russian police. Does this guest know if this is true or whether this is Putin's policy?
I know that if that were the case, he would just get more and more popular. As far as an activist group is concerned, you know, Putin has no direct control over local cops.
Right.
But these NGOs are financed entirely by Western capital and have created and imported this ideology onto Russia. With everything that Russia's been through, as if this could ever be an issue. It's just a way that, and most Russians, and especially, including communists, all but the most extreme liberals there see this movement as pure American decadence and as antithetical to the rebirth of a country that's been through so much. I know that these NGOs, like Amnesty International and the rest of it, has exaggerated these things. But like in Kiev, the homosexual parade, the pervert parade, had to be guarded by about 1,000 cops, or else it would be destroyed by the locals. The priest came out afterwards and purified the area from the filth. So, but as far as a policy is concerned, there's none that exists. But there certainly is a policy against foreign organizations and foreign money coming in and controlling a social life. There most certainly is.
Indeed. Alrighty. Why don't we take a caller? Let's take David in California. David, you have a question?
Yeah, about 3 years ago, I heard a story about the GDP, gross domestic product, of Russia and Italy being the same. And I checked a couple of sites back at that time, and it looked like it was about the same. I said, my God, Italy is microscopic compared to the size of Russia. Putin's probably doing good to keep the lights on. So, but it sounds from your earlier discussion that things have changed dramatically since then.
Well, Russia, as I said, is the sixth largest economy in the world. It's a highly diverse one. I've actually heard the story about the Italian thing. I haven't said anything wrong with it. Italy was highly industrialized prior to the EU, of course. And again, like Russia's sold it. Most of Russia's empty. Like the U.S., most of it is empty. And so they have certainly have room to grow. But, I'm not sure where Italy stands on the list of GDP, total, you know, value of the country is concerned, largest economy. I'm not sure where they are, but Russia was equal to Canada just maybe 5 years ago. I think they were just ahead of Canada. And so they may have gone up since then. I'm not sure.
Well, Canada's, what is that, like less than half the size of the United States in population. Most of it's huddled against the northern border of the United States for warmth.
Yeah, I mean, they have a lot in common in that respect. A lot of empty space.
Oh. Yeah, a tremendous amount of habitable space. I mean, of space, but not that much of it is easy to live in.
Well, parts of it get a bad rap. I mean, I'm one of these guys who likes the cold. Maybe not the 20 below that we got last week. But, you know, Siberia, with the exception of the Arctic part, is a very beautiful part of the world. It's absolutely gorgeous. The only problem I see with it is the bugs. When the snow melts and the standing water, the bugs will drive you insane. But the Canadians have the same problem. But other than that, yeah, Siberia is absolutely gorgeous.
Unless you're there in chains, right?
Well, the Siberian prisons prior to the Soviet Union weren't really prisons. You were in private homes. There was no one keeping an eye on you. Lenin wrote, got half his works in prison there. So it was very different from what was created in the Soviet era. It just kind of had a bad reputation, not from the Tsarist era, but from the Soviet Union. So that's what created, prisons. Tsar Nicholas wasn't a big fan of prisons in general. And medieval Russia and early modern Russia didn't have prisons at all. So it was very easy to escape from so-called prison in Siberia in the late 19th century.
Interesting. David, did you have another question or comment?
Well, I have a friend who was a Marine guard in embassy, whole bunch of embassies, and he had tons of friends all over the place, including Russia and Ukraine. And things are pretty good over there now. You're probably freer in Russia than you are in the United States.
Well, I know you're freer in China than you are in the United States, and yet we hear a lot of really terrible things about China. But it's pretty open. Yeah. Of course, the Communist Party does run China, 200 people, but as far as the ability to travel about, you can get on an airplane with a bottle of water, and you don't have to be frisked or take off your shoes or any of that nonsense. So,
David is correct. It's you know, there are more political parties that matter in Russia than in the U.S. You have a greater diversity of newspapers of every ideological point of view you could think of in Russia, and actually matter, that are mainstream, than in the U.S. You don't have just, you know, three or four major conglomerates. There's nothing, no ideological position that will get you fired from a job in Russia. I'm not so sure about China, but in Russia, there, you know, it's, so David's correct. It is freer in the abstract sense. Yeah.
Okay.
And, we'll see. The Duma has, 1,500 members? How do you write herd on that huge, a political body like that?
Oh, I forget the number off the top of my head. Things have changed. I mean, that's the old Supreme Soviet, and bodies above that were huge. But it's a manageable body. I mean, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head. If you were to ask me, I'd have to look that up.
Okay, well,
in other words, what we hear about Russia through the mainstream media is just plain inaccurate.
Well, Johnson's Law is at work. Most people don't know anything, so they could say whatever they want, and they're going to be believed. There's not a whole lot of people to say otherwise. So, yes. Remember, David, listen to me. The American press has no obligation to educate anybody. They have no obligation, abstract or otherwise, to tell the truth. They're there to sell papers or to get people to watch their stuff and to satisfy advertisers. They're not educational. They're not an educational institution whatsoever. They are to education what wrestling is to sports.
Right.
their obligation
is to sell papers. That's a good analogy.
Yeah. Their obligation is to get viewers and to sell papers or whatever to make their money. That's their obligation. Nothing more than that.
Interesting. All right, David, thank you for your phone call.
Okay.
Did you have another question?
Okay,
thank you so much. All right, let's take Charles in Florida. Oh, it's warm down there. Charles?
Not so warm. It's getting down in the 60s.
Oh.
No, it's not below zero.
Oh,
but,
oh
no, I mean,
so
that's warm to you.
Sorry for you. Oh, bless
you. That's warm for you in Chicago.
Oh, gosh. Yes.
My God.
I used to know Fred Farrell. That was his pen name. He wrote for Common Sense about Russia in the 70s and started, I think, 1968. He was talking about the old Jew-Bolshevik regime being overthrown in 1968. He said the Russian military had taken over. So I don't know if you have ever encountered him. He was a interesting fellow. He was, he thought of Stalin as being a great Russian chauvinist.
That's common.
You know that he had. Stalin had to bring a lot of things back, you know, rank in the military and grading in school. And, you know, there were illiterate doctors a friend of mine, you know, that grew up in the Ukraine was telling about, you know, people going to having degrees and they were illiterate. You know, look at this Lysenko, you know, Lysenkoism,
oh, yeah.
You know, the,
The genetics issue, so-called Mendelianism, Lamarckism, that was Stalin financed that particular view of Darwin. And you know, Lysenko was far from illiterate, but he was the official biologist of the USSR. He wasn't like Alina Ceausescu, you know. But
right.
I don't think you mean 60. I think you mean 38.
Yeah, during the 30s. You know, my friend Nina, she lived in Gulfport, you know, that's part of St. Petersburg. She had, she and her mother remembered the Holodomor, you know, the people dying, you know, with the collectivization of agriculture in the 30s, you know, and she and her mother had gotten out with the German army, you know, as he protected her. You know, the Red Army, if it had gotten hold of her, they would have raped her. She said that anybody that did something like that in the German army or their allies would have been shot. You know, but the Red Army was different.
Well, that's true. Why did Solzhenitsyn go to the gulags? Because he was captured by the Germans. He didn't do anything else.
Right. You couldn't admit, I've read some of Solzhenitsyn's, You couldn't admit in a Soviet novel that you'd ever been captured by the enemy, the Germans or whoever. You know, if you were, you would be subject to arrest.
Right to the camps, the re-education, because they were afraid that the stuff may have rubbed off on you. And that's all that Solzhenitsyn never did, was get captured.
Right.
I've been at this for a long time, and I've read, God, the amount of material I've read, so I'm surprised I'm still here, to absolutely make certain that either whether Stalin was a nationalist or not, and he most certainly is not. I have quotes from him in my new book,
right, that's true.
That 1931, he says, national and racial chauvinism is a vestige of the misanthropic customs characteristic of the period of cannibalism. I'm reading it as we're talking here right now. 1931, Stalin wrote that in Pravda. I'm sorry, 1936.
During the doctor's plot, you know, they could talk about rootless cosmopolitans, meaning Jews, you know, and
Think of it like this. The whole story about Stalin being this anti-Semite nationalist, it derives from this. Stalin needed to purge the party of people who may oppose him. Not an ideological ground.
Well, he's anti-Zionist. Yeah, that's true. He wasn't.
Stalin was always anti-Zionist.
Anti-Jewish. He was anti-Zionist.
It wasn't anti-Jewish, later. But it was anti-Zionist. That's true. And really,
yes,
the US,
right.
Israel went to the U.S. because the Soviet Union was destroyed after the war. You know, the U.S. got a better deal, gave a better deal than Stalin ever could. I mean, Stalin was surrounded by Jews his whole life.
Did you know that Reagan brought a whole load of Bolshevik Jews during his administration, the so-called Great Conservative, you know, a total phony. That's what the neocons are. Is all these Trotskyites that were undercover inside. They just came over here and set up shop again. They want to turn us into another Germany or Russia. You know, it would be like a Weimar Republic. We're in the Weimar Republic stage.
That's a very good point.
California, you can't say he or she, or you're arrested. You can't use pronouns. They tell you you get 20 years in jail or 10 years in jail, 20, or $1 million fine for boycott of Israel.
The way to view it is when Stalin began purging the party, of course the early Bolsheviks were about 90% Jewish. Putin has said that recently.
Right.
You can't deny it. So,
right, sure.
So it wasn't an attack on Jews as such. It was just because they all were, you know, and of course he was surrounded by Jews. He married
right,
two of them.
Right, of course.
His daughters married
Jews.
You know, So he was right. never, and he enforced the death penalty for anti-Semitism, which was not repealed during his era. But it was easy for the American left, had to invent the anti-Semitic Stalin, or else they'd have to admit that the old Bolsheviks were all Jews. So they weren't going to admit that. So they had to say, oh, this must have been an attack on Jews as such. And what you mentioned about the neocons, followers of Trotsky who hated, I mean, he was a Jewish nationalist before anything else, hated Stalin and the Soviet Union so badly that they would support anybody who made war on the USSR. And that's where the neocons come from. You're absolutely right.
Right. Sure.
But that's the mentality behind it. Either you say that the old Bolsheviks were all Jews, or Stalin was an anti-Semite. You have to see, and that's where that initially came from.
Well, to preserve the system, he had to bring back grading in school, rank in the military, religion. He had to bring all those. He became kind of a nationalist. By sheer necessity, that's what I'm saying.
Well, you know, I always tell people
by the logic of this, either the system would have of broken down, you know, before World War II.
Yeah.
If he hadn't done that, if he hadn't, you know, become kind of like whether a phony nationalist or a real nationalist.
It's just a matter of, well, he wasn't. I mean, those things aren't nationalism. I mean, what Charles is talking
right.
about is an important point. He's Trotsky and Kollontai, and Trotsky was more powerful than Lenin, engaged in all kinds of weird social experimentation, you know, collective child rearing, easy divorce, easy abortion. Within 5 years, the economy was in such turmoil from this. There were so many unwanted kids, and people began to just collapse morally. So even before Stalin, people said, we simply can't have this anymore. In other words, the family law system that was too radical for Trotsky and Lenin is what we have in the U.S. today. The notion of, you know, easy divorce, you know, everything, you know, easy
abortion.
And that was central. Now, Stalin did ban abortion in 1943, as did Nikolai Ceausescu, but that had more to do with population growth than any, you know, love of life. So what you say is an important point. The system was collapsing. I think the only thing that keeps our system together is drugs. They had Stalin, we had Prozac.
Have you seen where the governor of New Mexico won't send the National Guard troops to borders? There's a
this is getting
Mexican
bad.
Chauvinist. You know, he just. I guess he wants to join Mexico.
Well, the great thing about Trump, one great thing is he brought a lot of our people together, and he exposed, for anybody who's on the fence about the press and the system as a whole, they can't be on the fence anymore. He's forcing everything to a head. Yeah, I mean, I remember even when he was running, you had people saying, we're not going to enforce his law. This
wow.
is all happening right now. It's getting worse.
Gentlemen, we're going to take a quick minute break. We'll be right back.
It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony.
All righty. We are back, and I believe we still have our Florida gentleman, Charles, who is just suffering so greatly down there in that 60-degree weather. We're going to have to send our blessings.
Need anything for us? Need anything? Any care packages? Or?
my office was 52 degrees this morning. My office in my house. 52. Okay.
Is that all? Well, that's warm by Chicago standards, I think. It's been down below zero, hasn't it?
Yeah, but that's inside my house. That's inside my house because of the cold has just seeped in. But anyway, go ahead.
Oh, you mean outside. Oh, yeah, I wanted to bring up another thing about how naive people were around the time. National Geographic, May 1907, a famous journalist of the time was painting how easily these Jewish Bolsheviks were able to get away with when they were actually sentenced to Siberia. They just, things were just so lackadaisical. And,
right.
And you know, and on the Tsar was surrounded by Jews just like the Kaiser. The Kaiser was a damn chump. He was taken in by British propaganda. The Corbin report, I don't know if you've seen that on the
Charles?
You're cutting out.
I can't hear you.
Yeah. Charles, I think you're cutting me out.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Nicola, I mean, there were a few elite Jews at the end of the Russian Empire, but he was far from surrounded by them. That's certainly not true. He didn't trust them, and he's kind of pretty famous for that.
Did you know that, what's his name, the missing,
Charles, you're still cutting out.
I'm sorry.
I just heard you say Rasputin. So maybe we better cut you loose. Maybe it's all that heat.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, yeah. Thanks anyway. Thank you.
Thanks, Charles. Yeah. Yeah, it's all his suffering.
Yes.
He's losing his voice.
Yes, poor guy. let's take Mickey in the Carolinas. Mickey, are you there?
Diana, we're here. I'll just wait for that click to come through. And Matthew, you don't have to do anything. Charles has a brand new Sunbeam electric blanket on the way by Pony Express. We felt real sorry.
Oh, good.
Wonderful.
See, our people, is he the brotherhood I'm talking about here?
Yes, that's terrific.
Yeah, we were going to send some little cigarette lighter, but it's too dangerous for people his age. So here's a couple things I want to pass on. Yeah, I have a real good program going, and Matthew, thank you very much for everything you do. I know there's been some harm and hell involved in it. It always is. I just finished listening to Thomas Goodrich, Deanna, on Dennis Fetcho show this morning, and it was very, very good. He's always good, and he's always good to hear, too.
Absolutely.
Matthew, out there, there's a lemon.
Your voice is very familiar, but you didn't call in as Mickey before.
That's right.
But I haven't talked to you for a long time, and I wondered where you went. I'm glad that you called in.
I've been here. I listen once in a while. But there's a reason why this is going on. Okay. Anyway. Okay. There's a Lenin statue at the on the property of the University of Washington in Seattle, Washington.
Yep.
I find it very interesting why it's still standing after going through everything that happened in Charlottesville. And I'm very familiar with what happened in Charlottesville, too. You made some statements that are very interesting that I've not heard before. I hope that we can get you on another program, too, to get some more people from Charlottesville, because what came out of there was nothing but total propaganda.
Absolutely, yeah. It was
a total setup. Second day, we knew it was a total setup. We knew exactly who was involved with it. And this Antifa crowd need to know that people who showed up in Charlottesville had a permit to be there.
That's right.
They didn't come there with anything except good intentions.
That's right.
And when Antifa showed up, they did not have a permit, and they should have been shot on sight. These people are just vicious, and they need to be treated as vicious, too.
They said they were going to kill us. That's what they said over and over again. We're going to kill them. We're going to smash them. We're going to bash their heads in. That's what they said over and over again online.
Yeah, yeah. I was stunned to hear some of your comments. And if you don't mind, I'm going to try and get some people to get in touch with you. If you don't mind, Dan, we're going to kind of pass them on to a couple more people. They're right smack in the middle of it. We also have two people, Dr. Michael Heal, and also David Duke are being sued, and shut them up, and this is going to stop in this country.
That's exactly right. And of course, we have guys in jail who are innocent.
Wow.
The legal system will be weaponized. And we got innocent people in jail, and the judge who's involved in this.
Gentlemen, we do have to go to a quick break. Mickey, stay over if you'd like to, and we'll be right back.
It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead.
All righty, I'm going to cut off the music here and get back to our conversation. We had Mickey in the Carolinas. And
I want to address a few things that Mickey brought up.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, you know, I know he did too. I followed the Ramos and Goodwin trial. I'm friends with Jacob Goodwin's mother. I did some research for her concerning his appeal. You know, you said that they weaponized the legal system, and you're absolutely right. It's a great way to put it, because in the Ramos trial, of course, the defense attorney threw it. I mean, he deliberately lost the case.
Wow.
But in the Goodwin case, it was different. They had video evidence. They showed the jury the video of what happened. It couldn't be clearer. He was convicted anyway. So even video evidence isn't sufficient. And what it comes down to is no jury wants to be given all the propaganda. And it should have been moved. It shouldn't have been in Charlottesville, but it was. They tried to get it moved, and it was denied. And change of venue was pretty obvious. They're not going to be the ones to let neo-Nazi murderers go free. So that verdict came out of fear. And the sentence that he received was far greater than that judge has given for far worse crimes in that department. So it was clearly politicized. I don't know what's going to happen with his, you know, the family's really cash-strapped. They need help. But how that appeal goes, I don't know. But when you have actual video and photographic evidence that doesn't work, you know you got a problem. If our people are arrested, we're in serious trouble, if it's a political issue.
Wow.
Very well put. You made some good comments that I want to kind of pass on. I have a couple more things to pass on very quickly. And after that, if Ken will take my phone number, I'll give you my phone number. Dr. Johnson, if you'll give me a shout, or Deanna, I'd like to talk with you personally and give you some background of what's going on. You'll be really interested in knowing what I know.
Okay.
Anyway, the other issue is my question to you, Dr. Johnson, is Putin, one of my favorite families in the whole history of this earth happened to be the Romanovs. And my question is, it's been brought to my attention a couple of years ago that Putin may be a direct lineage of the Romanov family. Is that correct?
I've not heard that. I've not come across, you know, and I'm up on all of the royalist, works in Russian and in English. Coming there, I haven't come across it. But,
okay.
But again, you know, being a Romanov isn't necessarily the criteria. You know, Romanovs only started ruling Russia since 1613. And I appreciate your support of them. The Romanovs, you know, for the most part, other than the 18th century, of course, had tremendous, tremendous leaders. And, but I've not heard that about Putin, but he is certainly treated. When he went to Mount Athos, essentially the Orthodox capital of the world, he was asked by the abbot to go into the, section that the Byzantine emperors used to stand in. He didn't want to, but they asked him to. That's how they're viewing him on Mount Athos. So, you know, there's no doubt that he has royal elements in him, but I don't know about direct lineage.
Well, I would think if it was true, that would be well known, but I would certainly like to think so. I do know probably about 80% of the population of the United States is behind him, and they'd rather have him come over and probably run for president next time around.
I think that's true. I think his image is really great. And it's really who he is. You know, he's, you know, black belt in judo. He's in great shape. He's a plain talker. You know, he's a simple guy in how he lives. Yeah, I think Americans would love him. So the press has got to go into overtime, making him into a monster, and they have very little to go on.
Well, he's been in a position where he's had to make some difficult decisions and a hardliner. And, but he's come out smelling pretty well, and he seems like he has his people in mind rather than anything else. So that's where it's all at. Without your people, you've got nothing else. You've got borders and dirt. That's it. You've got to have the people there. So this invasion we're going through here in the States is unprecedented. The only people who could be held responsible, who need to be held responsible, are your congressional members. They need to be rounded up, put in jail, given 10 days worth of due process, and then ask them one last question. Do you want a blindfold or not? So exactly where they need to go. These people are criminally corrupt. And they're destroying everything that's been built for the last, 1,000 years. This is crazy.
Well, I want to go even higher than that. I'm more worried about, the people who finance their campaign. You know, the major bankers.
Oh yeah.
You know,
oh yeah.
People who show up at the Bilderberg meetings. These are the people who, you know, I mean, not this last presidential election, the one before it, Goldman Sachs gave $16 million to both parties. You know, so, you know, I think these are far more powerful than any politician. But as I said before, Putin's popularity comes from the fact that he threw all of these Jewish oligarchs out of the country, you know, in his first few days. If he shot them, he'd be even more popular.
You begin to see the billionaire Jews coming out of the woodwork with their wanting to be president. They have something to contribute, such as Howard Schultz out there in Seattle, who heads up Starbucks. He's a whack job. Bloomberg, yeah. Michael Bloomberg is another whack job.
That's right.
Barney Fife Saunders is also another whack job, a Jew. And these people have got no contributions to make to society whatsoever. They got their own world to live in. It doesn't apply to what's here in the state. This in the United States is different than what they think it is.
That's right.
They can sit there and take their money and buy whatever they want to. They've done that. All the judges, the prosecutors, the lawyers, a lot of your military, they've been bought off. And so where what's left? Nothing but chaos. We've got third, fourth world countries coming up here, and they're turning this place into a cesspool. And the only people I say are responsible, not the only ones, but to start right there with your representatives. This ain't cut loose. I think they're going to start a minority war here. If it cuts loose, then they need to be held responsible, and that's the end of that. I mean, They've enjoyed their livelihood in this country free, and they're going to have to pay the price for it, too. That's the way I see it going.
Well, I remember, I mean, they have to be held responsible. And I remember when Trump first threw his hat in the ring, I think Sears and Roebuck was the first company to come out against him. And they're the ones, and it was big firms that came out against him, because he was in favor of curtailing immigration substantially, illegal and otherwise. And that was his main thing. So when these guys see that their source of cheap labor, demographic shifts, votes, going out the window, even slightly, they turned on Trump with a ferocity that I've never seen. And then since then, I've learned exactly how dependent the U.S. is, or the elites are, on immigration. On cheap labor coming from abroad. It's far greater than even I thought. They're a part of the elite economy. Of course, they drive down wages. And they have a tendency to be more docile because they shouldn't be here in the first place. But elite capital is very much dependent on, illegal and legal immigration. And that's
the middle class been pretty much wiped out. That's what's happened through Clinton and then NAFTA.
That's right.
What they're going to end up doing is that the reason why all this is happening is you're going to see America will survive, but it will not recover. That's all there is to it. Companies are not coming back to America. They're outside of the United States because they only have 2 or 3% taxes. They come back in here as 20%. They're not coming back. That's just plain and simple. The two processes you want to keep in mind is that the elites want to preserve the natural resources of the earth. They're being depleted so fast it's unreal. They went over the top. 1980. So they've got to stop the depletion of these natural sources of Earth. They also have to go through depopulation. That's how they're going to do it. So those are two things you don't want to forget.
And these are
preservation, natural resources, and excuse me, and depopulation is where they're going. They're not going to stop until they get there either.
And that's why Venezuela is so important to them. It's one of the reasons why it's so important.
Everybody's like you brought up real good points. Everybody's hurtling around the natural resource. Look in Africa and look up in Romania and Ukraine. Those are a lot of natural resources up through there, in South America. And look at who's hovering around them to preserve those for themselves. That's the longevity right there. In 25 words or less, that's exactly what's going on, and it'll continue to. If you're familiar with the Georgia Guidestones, I take my clients down there.
Oh yeah.
In France.
Oh yeah.
I take them down there and have their pictures taken right in front of them. Absolutely awesome. The word awesome, they invented the word awesome. That's a huge place. Now I'm taking up enough of your time. I really appreciate doing this. I'm going to leave my phone number with Ken if you'll take me down. I want to ask one last question to everybody and directly to you, Dr. Johnson, and that is, do you know where the largest Russian horsemen are located outside of Russia?
Russian what is located?
Horsemen. The Russian horsemen. Russia is well known for its horsemen.
The Cossacks especially, yeah.
Yeah. Do you know where the largest Russian horsemen are located outside of Russia?
You mean largest? You mean the largest number of people?
Yes.
Well, where the Cossacks have gone, you find communities, of course, large in Ukraine, in Central Asia, and in Turkey, and prior to the revolution in China, northern China.
I'm going to give you the answer.
Oh, that wasn't Spartanburg. I wasn't supposed to answer that?
I'm going to give you the answer to the question, and that is, the answer is Spartanburg, South Carolina.
Interesting.
Well, what is down there?
Look in Tryon, North Carolina, and Columbus, North Carolina. You'll find Fence, FENSE. That's where we held the Olympics right there. And that's just loaded with Russian horsemen.
Probably a Cossack background.
Not well known. Anyway, if Ken will take me down, I'm going to leave my number. If you'll please give me a shout real quick. Some things to pass on.
Okay. Thank you, Mickey. All righty. Let's take Lenny in California.
Thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to this broadcast. I came in on the tail end of the last hour, about the last 15 minutes, and I heard the guest say that, first let me say this to the person from the chat room who asked a question about Putin being homophobic. I can tell you what he said during the Sochi Olympics not too long ago. And he said that gays and I remember the media here tried to make a big thing out of it. And he said the gays were free to come and go as they pleased, but he wanted them to leave the children alone. Do not push this off on the children. Okay, now let me say this. I have nothing but respect for any species that has the balls to stand up to be what God made it to be.
Okay.
And I don't want to be taken wrong in saying that, but I simply find the man fascinating. Now, about that clip that you were talking about when he made all the so-called oligarchs sign that agreement not to take the business out of the country.
Right.
And I remember that part. It's called Putin versus the oligarchs. It's a documentary. To all the listeners who want to go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, you're right. It's on YouTube. The whole documentary and that little bit where he crashes into the board meeting. There's at least three or four copies on YouTube right now.
Yeah, and if you look at it, they had all but ripped that country apart. It had turned into the Weimar Republic. And when I look back at Yeltsin being the drunk that America loved, and Borisovsky at the time, who was dating Yeltsin's daughter and beating her, okay,
right.
And knowing that Yeltsin had such a love for his daughter, and then he would beat her to go back and tell Yeltsin what he needed from Yeltsin through her, and then Yeltsin ended up signing everything over. But there was a meeting between Putin and Yeltsin on Yeltsin's deathbed, and that's when Yeltsin supposedly asked him to bring back Russia to his glory. Now, Borisovsky's and the other oligarchs had jumped behind Putin, and they had flown Putin to Threadneedle Street in England to take the banker's oath, if you get my meaning. And but Putin played them all. He pretended to be for the oligarchs, but when he got back to Russia, he got to work for the Russians. And let me just reiterate this. I got nothing but respect for any species who has the dignity to be what God made it to be. And say what you want, listeners. This man is one of the best that God has put on this earth to help straighten this out. This evil is far beyond what any of us can comprehend. Now, I know that there's a plan. I know what they're planning to do. They want to, the powers that think they be, want to scapegoat a certain, quote-unquote, color minority group for their own bad karma that they created. Now, when you look back at this particular group, they've been kicked out of European countries how many times? 106 times? Do you know that?
Yeah.
At least.
Every city, every country, yeah.
Yeah, so, well, I understand what they're, you know, first off, they got as much mileage out of they got as much mileage as they could out of that character named Barack, I call Insane Obama. Cause not any sane man would have taken that job and did what he did. But what a lot of people don't understand and do not know, do you remember the late Senator Richard Lugar from Indiana?
Yes.
You remember when they so-called had dismantled all the Russian factories and all of the Russian, and had taken control of most of Russian nukes and stuff, so there was a fact-finding group that Richard Lugar took. It was like in the late 90s, early 2000, and he took over to Russia to make sure the Russian was dismantling their nukes and stuff since the former Soviet Union, former so-called Soviet Union had fallen apart. And he took an apprentice with him by the name Barack Hussein Obama. Now, before they could get on the plane to leave, the Russians surrounded the plane and threatened to arrest Lugar for bringing a spy. And it wasn't that they accused Obama of being a spy for the Secret Service or the FBI or the CIA. They accused him of being a British MI5 spy.
No, but Lugar or Obama?
No, Obama.
Okay.
Obama. And it was Lugar that begged. It was Lugar that begged for them to let them go and let them take Obama with him.
Wow.
I like this guy. Deanna, I like this guy.
Yeah. Well, okay, let's keep him over. We'll go to the break. Oh, we've only got 10 more minutes. Okay, but, yeah, we'll be right back. Back, and our guest today is Dr. Matthew Johnson. His website is rusjournal.org, and Lenny has hung up. We do have some other callers, Mark in Louisiana, and make it really quick because we're running out of time. Mark, quick.
Yes, good evening. Yes, I understand and acknowledge that Putin has done great things, especially bringing Russia from the abyss due to that, you know, scumbag Yeltsin, who did probably more harm than even than Stalin. He was a pathetic drunk that turned over, you know, the country to the hyenas with the Star of David.
I agree.
But at the same time, I'm also very concerned with how Putin has treated his friends. If I would have been in his place, I would have forged an alliance with Iran, a la NATO, in Syria, in Venezuela, in China, in North Korea, such that anything that NATO would do against any of these countries, that would be considered an attack on Russia. Well, he hasn't done anything about it. You know, the United States keeps slapping around it. It even killed, Trump even killed Russian soldiers, and he did absolutely nothing about it.
He created the, well, helped create the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which was
That's not an alliance.
That's exactly what it is. It's not as formal as NATO. That's true. But, and China has made many, many statements that any attack on Russia militarily would be an attack on China. And they said that relative to Crimea, especially when they have investments and they have their people there.
Yeah, but not on Iran, for instance, not on Syria.
Well, Iran is a member
Israel
of the
keeps
SCO.
Attacking those countries, and, you know, he doesn't do anything about it.
What's he supposed to do?
Bomb the living hell out of Israel. That's what he should do.
I don't think that's ever going to happen.
Yes, and I think I know why.
But Israel has nuclear weapons.
He's not totally free.
It would be a difficult thing to do. It would be... in a country with nuclear weapons, you know, bombing them Israel's policy. If they're ever up against the wall, they bring it, put the nukes up and bring them right back down again, and they'll destroy anybody who's doing it. We may fantasize.
We'll have to have a showdown with little Israel, and let's see who comes on top.
Well, that's going to happen. There's no doubt. And I certainly hope that.
Well, I hope so.
I think, you know, and you're right, the U.S. is pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. But Iran is a member of the SCO, and it's an economic alliance, it's a cultural alliance. There's also substantial military cooperation. And this is one of the reasons that, you know, Iran really can't be invaded right now. So he did do this. And, you know, China to a great extent is dependent on Russian oil and Russian technology. And that alliance has been mutually beneficial and is the one thing that's keeping the American empire at bay, in my opinion.
Wow, we're out of time. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Dr. Matthew. Bless your heart for joining me today.
My heart feels blessed.
Thank you. All righty, take care, and we'll talk with you next week. Listeners.
It was a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. My honor, my pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye now. Bye.